session number 11078, reel 1.
Commander going reel 1. Could you tell me, first of all, when you joined the Fleet Air Arm?
I joined in 1938 from submarines because of a mismatch of promotion prospects, whereby I would have not got command until I was 2.5, at least that's what I thought in those days. And so I volunteered as an observer, and after a training course at Ford, took passage in the Cossack to the Med to join the Glorious.
Can you tell me about the Glorious, what kind of a ship she was to serve on?
Well, Glorious was one of the original aircraft carriers. They'd been light battle cruisers in their day, and they were some of the first ships to be converted to aircraft carriers. Well, she had Captain Admiral Lister, later Admiral Lister, and was on the whole a very happy ship at that time, though she suffered from one of the faults, early faults of aircraft carriers, of being ship's company, a dividing line between the ship's company and the air. At that time, the air department was one third RAF pilots, and all the ground crew were RAF troops. This was before the Navy took command of the Naval Air Service in 1939. And when that happened, all the RAF officers were taken back to the RAF, and we were left with 400 RAF troops. And as being an observer, I was also anxious for some ship's work to do. It so befell that I became the Fleet Air Arm adjutant without knowing a damn thing about RAF law or anything else. So, but that was very interesting. And for the first year in the ship, when we had Admiral Lister, well, a lot of the training was done of night flying with an eye, ultimately, I think, to a Taranto operation. I think it's worth realizing that the aeroplanes were Swordfish and the fighters were Nimrods and Ospreys. Nobody had almost heard of a monoplane aircraft in the Fleet Air Arm. And also, there was no beacon to get yourself home by, and no crash barrier. So the deck had to be cleared after each landing of an aircraft. And in the course of that time, I was very lucky because I had this Fleet Air Arm adjutant job, some work as flight deck officer, observing in 825 Squadron, a comfortably busy life.
How did the night flying practice go?
Well, they had to develop night flying, which they did by having very dim side lights up the deck and sector lights at the stern. And, well, I don't know exactly how I go. All I used to do is sit in the back seat and hope for the best. But we... the pilots were a very, very high standard for those days. And, of course, the aircraft, you were talking about speeds of 80 knots and 100 knots. So it wasn't... I suppose, ultimately, as hazardous as it might have been.
How did the pilots feel about the night flying, though? Were they
just got on with
it.
They just got on with it. I think you've got to realize that people in those days put it this way. The Navy that I joined in 1931 was a big ship Navy. And the submarines, on the one hand, glorified people who walked around in overalls, you know what I mean? And flying people who were rather extrovert and, foolhardy individuals to undertake this sort of thing, light-hearted individuals, I think, didn't realize, the Navy didn't appreciate them, but which meant that the Fleet Air Arm, for instance, and certainly submarine service, were determined to prove, as they ultimately did prove, that they were the fighting arm of the Navy.
So you were on your mettle?
Oh, very much so, I think. And, of course, we were all very much more light-hearted in these days, weren't we? I think the best example of that was... after... just before war broke out, we had a new captain, who's Captain Doyle Hughes, very eminent ex-submarine officer, who, as in John Winton's book, Aircraft Carrier Goris, was, in my view, a megalomaniac and determined to... Carrier Goris, to get the VC. In fact, as in that book, is a story I've told before now. War had been declared and he was captain, and he arranged for one of those lovely little boxes that you used to find in ships for the landing parties carrying revolvers in. They were glass fronted boxes held with chains so that they should use them, summoned up on the bridge, and having got this thing up there, my boss, who was commander flying, asked him what it was for, and he said, well, I want that so that I can shoot any of my officers who might fail me in action, which was not really a sort of thing to make everybody terribly enthusiastic.
How much personal contact with him did you have?
Not very much, I'm glad to say. I was actually, one of my duties with this Fleet Air Arm business was rushing up and down the deck with waving flags, aeroplanes on and off, you see. And we had a feeling that if he would find a fit of wild enthusiasm, he'd shoot the commander flying first and then the winger on the deck out second. I had him little contact, but it was an appalling thing, the morale of the ship deteriorated terribly. Well, then, once war was declared, we went through the canal. Well, we did one operation in the Med, and we went through the canal and were the biggest ship to go up to that date to have gone through the canal. And then we did one of these hunter groups that was the sort of part of misguided naval strategy at the beginning of the war, which was a carrier, a battleship, and a couple of destroyers at a focal point in the hope of catching a pocket battleship or whatever. And we sat around the end of the Red Sea near Socotra for 63 days, in which we had 6 hours ashore. Three of which, I might mention, were on Socotra, which the naval pilot, Indian Ocean pilot, said was a cannibal island, but we didn't see any cannibals. So, yeah. And it was in that, on that, at that period, that I had my first stitching.
How did that come about?
Well, we got a lot of new pilots to replace the RAF ones, and a lot of them had only just been trained. And so when they did their first reconnaissance outside the site of the ship, they generally would send a sort of ancient observer who was reasonably expendable in with them to sort of nurse them home and back again. So I was deputed for that, not unsurprisingly. And this young lad, he was one of the early midshipman pilots. A very nice chap. And he had three aircraft going off on this do, and his sub-flight leader said, told him that he must try and do a rather sort of fancy form-up before going off on the recce, you see, which was that the first aircraft took off would go up the port side of the ship, second aircraft would come up the starboard side of the ship, and the third aircraft would turn to starboard, and they both wobble into 1, 2, 3, you see, into formation. So this lad was number two, coming up the starboard side of the ship. He suddenly realized when he'd got just past the stern that he hadn't enough room to make a turn up the starboard side. So he did a very, very tight turn. And, of course, Newton and the Apple took charge. And we wobbled it, we popped into the sea.
When was this?
That was in, I've got the dates in my flying logbook. But it was, when was it? 1939.
After the war had started.
Oh, yes, after the war, yes.
So.
And we went into the sea with a big splash, and all the petrol started coming out of the tanks. And if you want to swim in water with a lot of petrol in it, you find it attacks the more sensitive portions of your body. And there was I paddling like mad to try and get out of this when we were picked up by the whaler from the attendant destroyer. And the bowman of that hoiked me in a bed like that, and I thought very rudely. So I said to him, I hope you realize what you're doing to me. And he said, "Oi, look over there." And there was a shark. So it was it was a very pretty little story. And that shark we went back to the attendant destroyer and got sort of brushed off. And then we went back, were pulled back to Glorious. And that shark followed us all the way. It was all because I dug my dividers into my knee and was bleeding a bit. So that was one entertainment.
Why do you say the hunter groups were a misguided idea?
Carriers were intensely vulnerable. as was proved by the courageous. And the courageous was in one of these hunter groups. And she was doing this. You see, in the early days, and right all the way through, a carrier, if it's flying its aircraft off or landing them on, is on a fixed course because she's got to be into the wind. You see? So she's on a fixed course for a considerable time, which is absolute money for old rope for a submarine, which is what happened with the Courageous. And anyway, this whole business of the hunter groups, if you look at your atlas, it's like a needle in a haystack. It's not as though the German trade was going to come to focal points or anything, like you did with convoys in the Atlantic. So what were you doing? I think you were endangering valuable ships. What looked to be a sort of happy excess. I think you've got... Oh, dear. Now I'm off, aren't I? I think you've got to appreciate that naval thinking was not attuned to the air. Right? It either thought it could do a lot more than it could do, or was a lot more circumscribed than it was. And it won't got... You really... The evolution of the air, naval air, in my view, came to the use of carriers like the we did and the Americans did in small groups, very heavily defended, or groups of carriers, to carry out definite objects or to provide cover to other ships, right? That, in fact, what the carrier did was to take naval warfare from being in sight of fleets to out of sight of fleets. That was the other thing. The next use of the carrier, which was really effective, as I see it, was the carrier with the convoy. Now, the carrier with the convoy was of use in that it kept the attacking submarines of the convoy out of effective range of the convoy, or had it for that effect. It wasn't so much important that it sank submarines, but it kept them away. Now, if you look... I'm sorry, I really am away, aren't I?
That's all right.
If you look at your naval history and things afterwards, you have a sort of monstrous write-ups of Matapan, because Matapan was the last sort of action in sight of enemy fleets in sight of each other. If you go back, the Americans, who were bloody quick to learn, developed the carrier group, attacking out of sight and guarded by battleships, not being guards for battleships. It took us a long time to learn that.
What other duties did you go on to did the Glorious go on to next?
Well, when I was doing all those things, the various jobs I had, right up to the end of the year, because, I mean, actually running the Fleet Air Arm Division was quite a thing, and also flying, and also doing work on the deck. I had quite a comfortable life. The ship stayed there, went down to Colombo, and then came back again. But we left at Colombo.
You were telling me earlier that you and your brother officers thought that misfortune was going to come to the Glorious.
Yes, we did.
Why did you think that?
Well, of course, well, because of the captain's wild enthusiasm for all the most extraordinary things. He told all the pilots that he knew how to fly things. His whole enthusiasm, he wasn't really convinced of the air as such. It's just the atmosphere he induced. And you'll find out later, there's a, in the whole of the Heath episode.
What was the Heath episode?
Oh, it's, you'll find it all in... Carrier Glorious explains it completely.
In
could not be
Glorious.
Better than me. So there's no point in my illuminating that. So back I came at... in November 39, taking passage, which was fascinating, in an old AMC, which was an ancient BI liner, AMC, our merchant cruiser, BI liner, with push and pull engines, you know, gorgeous thing. Anyway, we took passage there, and that to Malta, through Canal, Malta, Marseille, cross Marseille, home. Joining 819 Squadron in January 1940. I might say just in parenthesis, In Glorious, I was in 825 Squadron, which was a famous squadron that actually attacked the Bismarck later on. So that's that. Well, then, 819 formed up at Ford. We were all either from the Glorious or the Ark, and we were all experienced in night flying, and we were going to join the new, brand new carrier, the Illustrious.
Where did you join her?
We joined her in July. When did we join? I can tell you when we joined. Right. In about April or so, a number of the pilots and observers went to Bertram Newton to drop mines off the Dutch coast, and it was quite interesting there. When they planned this operation, they found that the aircraft had insufficient range to get there and get back again. So they conceived the idea of putting, there it is, a long-range tank in the observer's seat, putting the observer in the air gunner's seat and dispensing with the air gunner. It was very uncomfortable and very awkward, and the petrol used to drop out of the tank in your face. Anyway, but so that is quite relevant to later on. So in June we joined Illustrious, which was everything the Glorious was. The last stages of the Glorious was not. She was a marvellous ship, a wonderful captain, the and commander and the officers, all of whom were determined to integrate the air and the ship completely, which they did with incredible effect.
You joined her in the Mediterranean, did you?
No, we joined her when she was working up, we went off to Bermuda to work up. And there's one nice thing that the fighters were, we had a very, what can I say, innovative command of flying, and we tried to fly the fighters off at anchor in Bermuda, and when they went off, suddenly the wind dropped, and there was no room for them to land on, so one of them landed on the Sea Island golf course, which was not very popular at that time. But we worked up there, and then set off for the Med. Now,
so you missed all the crisis in Europe with Norway and Dunkirk. And
yes,
so
we didn't have. We never caught that at all. No, we didn't. And we missed, apart from Dunkirk, we did one sortie or two sorties at Dunkirk, in which we flew at about 3,000 feet up the middle of the North Sea to search for E-boats. It's rather amusing. There were these ancient aeroplanes flying out the middle of the North Sea in a gorgeous sunny day. And we saw nothing. That night, Goebbels said the North Sea was a German lake, but it was a pretty stupid lake in that case.
This would have been June.
That was before that. That was Dunkirk time, which was a little bit earlier. So, to the Med we went.
Were you based in Alexandria?
It was always either Alex or yes, it was all Alexandria. We never went to Malta and the Lustrous. And we used to be disembarked to a place called Decayla, which was an aerodrome just west of Alex.
By now, the Italians had actually come into the war.
Yes, they had. They had indeed.
How soon did you start in conflict with them?
After Bermuda, the ship came back, and we disembarked for a short while to get stores and the like before going off to the Med. And I said we went to the Med in June. We didn't. We didn't get to the Med until August. Now, from that time onwards, we did, excluding Taranto, a series of raids at Calato, Tripoli, Lyros, Stampelia. We even disembarked ashore to an RAF forward aerodrome in the desert called Fuka to drop some mines on Mirza Matru. And then included in that, towards the end, was Taranto. All right.